Hi, welcome to Sacred Conversations with Vision Battlesword. This is an audio series created by me and by the Sacred Light spiritual community for our own benefit as well as for anyone else that might be interested to hear it. This represents a new kind of podcast or a new type of audio series that I call a community conversation. So I'll be talking with the Sacred Light spiritual community and we'll explore all types of topics from truth to philosophy, spirituality, consciousness, psychedelics, and many, many more. And the goal of this is just to explore reality, to explore truth, and to see what all of the different pieces and all the different perspectives are of reality that we can put together into an integration of an entirely new philosophy. So I hope you'll join me for this journey, and without further ado, here's our episode. Thanks. What's been interesting for you these days? What have you been thinking about?
Been thinking a lot about marriage and the future. I'm getting married, you know, in October, of course. And yeah, like responsibility. I've been this idea that every time you upgrade, there's a connection between upgrading your life and selflessness. And in order to carry, it's like almost like in order to carry more of the world's weight, you can't be carrying so much of your own weight. And so you have to let go of some addictions or let go of some habits or patterns in order to level up to the next phase or echelon of life. And this is, that's the idea I got. Jordan Peterson talks about it a lot. And it's biblical in some sense. Like he's like Abraham, he was still living in his father's tent and then got called to this great adventure, but he had to leave the comfort of his father's care in order to go out into the world where it's dangerous to become, you know, the father of Israel, right? And so that's been on my mind, you know, when I analyze my life and some old habits or patterns or addictions, frankly, which is another word for it, that I keep wanting to hang on to when I know that they're probably not serving me. You know, they're selfish in some way. Oh, I want to feel this way, so I'm going to eat this thing or do this thing or go to this place. And yeah, so I've been thinking about that.
How does this piece about addiction, responsibility, and letting things go, how does this all tie back into marriage or commitment?
Sure. Well, with me personally, it's connected to cannabis and my use of cannabis.
Yeah.
And my partner doesn't love that practice. I just took a year off. Uh-huh. But before that, I was 20 years on.
Wow.
Yeah. I like the joke. It's like I only used cannabis one time from 2003 to 2023.
Yeah. What was that like?
Being stoned every day for 20 years?
Yes.
You don't see the water you swim in, right?
Like, yes.
So I don't know. I think I have listened to Andrew Huberman's podcast about cannabis, which is quite damning in its effects and brain chemistry. And, you know, luckily I didn't use it until I was 18, you know, a handful of times when I was younger. And so the whole connection to like schizophrenia and stuff, I'm not super worried about. But there is a tendency, I mean, it changes your vocal inflection, your whatever part of the brain that is responsible for movement, it affects that. And so you're less likely to take action on things. And so there is like this connection with laziness and being a stoner, right? But, you know, I created a pretty good life for myself through all that. You know, I had a career in the liquor industry. What you can say was that successful or not, you know, you could look at that both ways. But I built my own business, started writing a book, but finished it in the year I was sober. So I think there's something there, or the year I was off cannabis. And so in the Huberman podcast, they talk a little bit about like state-dependent learning. Are you familiar with this concept?
Tell me.
So basically, if you learn a skill under one brain state, then you'll replicate that skill most efficiently or proficiently under that same brain chemistry condition, right?
Sure, that makes sense.
And so if you expand that a little bit. It's like, okay, well, I learned how to be an adult basically from 18 to whatever under this state, you know? Yeah. And there wasn't like I was smoking every day all day, but definitely smoking daily, you know, for a very long time. And that's very powerful medicine, the cannabis, and really beautiful, and it kind of resets you. And but like anything, you use it too much, it loses, the power wanes. You
know? Yeah. I'm not a big fan.
Right, sure.
I used it daily also. I was, you know, more or less continually stoned for probably only about 2 to 2.5 years, let's say.
And you're how old?
I was a teenager, you know, somewhere between 16 and 18-ish. And yeah, I've got a lot of different thoughts about everything that you surfaced about state-dependent learning. That's very interesting to me. And the age, like being in a very specific state of awareness and medicine state, for that matter, for that long, but also for almost, you know, that's basically like a season of life. Mm-hmm. That's like your young adulthood, mm-hmm. basically. If you think childhood, 0 to 20, young adulthood, 20 to 40, midlife, right. 40 to 60, elderhood, 60 to 80. Mm-hmm. You're an entire season of, you had the cannabis season.
Sure did.
Of your life, which was your young adulthood.
Yeah.
I had a like a brief blip on my late childhood, but it went pretty deep.
Right.
You know, I went down the rabbit hole pretty far. And when I came up for air, have I ever told you about my like formative medicine experience that happened when I was 18 to 19 years old? And
Yeah.
Well, that was the experience that set me on a completely different life trajectory. And I sobered up in a night. I sobered up in a 24-hour period.
Because you overdosed or something. Tell me what happened.
I wouldn't say I overdosed, and I don't necessarily want to tell the story right now.
Okay.
But I'll just say that I had a very, very powerful psychedelic experience that changed my mind, rewired my mind,
right?
In my opinion, rewired my brain. And I went in, you know, stoned, drunk, a substance abuser, and I came out completely sober for 5 years after that.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. And when I came out, it was really scary for a while. I'd say it was a good 6 months, at least, maybe a little longer, that I was in the process of sobering up over that whole period of time. I felt like I was coming out of a fog that I didn't know I was in. Just like what you said before, you don't know the water you're swimming in, or you're not aware of the water while you're swimming in it. And so in sobering up, like overnight like that, I suddenly became aware of the water. Mm. I suddenly became aware of the fog. And realized, like, wow, I'm not as sharp as I used to be. I can tell now. Like, I'm trying to go for those. I'm in a different state. My state has changed.
Right.
And I'm trying to go for those tools that used to just be right there, whether they be memory or clear thinking, critical thinking, quick thinking, that sort of thing. And realize it's like, wow, I think I hurt myself.
Right.
And it came back slowly over time. But I realized it's like, that fog, and I do think it's the cannabis specifically. Mm-hmm. That fog, it's like it takes a long time to flush out of your body. Just the substance itself
is soluble,
stored in your body for a really long time. That's why it's one of the substances that can be tested for, you know, for almost, you know, one of the longest periods of time that they can still be detected. And I think the influence that it has on your consciousness is similarly durable. You know, it lasts for a long time, and it kind of slowly fades away. And so, I became kind of a lot more suspicious and maybe had more of a negative impression after that. And later in life, when I tried it again, I didn't like it. I was like really confused in a certain way about why did I ever like this?
Interesting.
Why did this appeal to me? What was I getting out of it? And of course, being in a completely different frame of mind, stage of life, different experiences and different social pressures, different peer group, all sorts of different things like that, of course, can have a, you know, set and setting, as they say, is supremely important to what a medicine experience is going to be like. But yeah, in all of the experience that I've had with it in my adult life, I don't think it's good medicine for most people, most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there's some reason why it's here on this planet with us and for us, and why we have very specific receptors in our brain that seem to be just for it, which is weird when you think
about
it.
Well, that's not entirely true. No, okay. we produce our own cannabinoids, endogenous cannabinoids, but it's like a hundredth of what you would receive from one toke of marijuana, you know, and so... And a lot of those happen, and I only know this because I've recently listened to this podcast, which helped me, like, that I listened to it the first time right when I was about a month sober, and I kind of was getting some tinges, some desire, and I was like, all right, I need to listen to this to kind of affirm my desire to quit, you know. And yeah, it seems to be very early in life, though, those are very sensitive, and you produce more endogenous cannabinoids, but it kind of wanes as you come out of like 2, 3, 4 years old. Yeah, but there's definitely an affinity for it, you know. Yeah, like you said, in our neurochemistry.
I think there's a use case for it as a psychedelic. That's I put it in that category personally.
Definitely.
I think there's a use case for it. I think that there's a reason why it's here, along with the other plant medicines. I think that there's certain aspects of that psychedelic state that can be very beneficial for enhancing creativity, certainly enhancing sensory experience. I think that it can create spiritual experiences. I think if you were to put it on the same table with ayahuasca and psilocybin mushrooms and peyote or wachuma, and like put it, if you were to put it on that same table and use it in that same way, then I think I'm a fan.
Right.
But I think the way we use it in our society is a lot more like alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I also put alcohol on that same table with ayahuasca and the other plant medicines. I think there is a use case for alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Medicinally, it's an anesthetic.
Yeah.
It's a disinfectant. You know,
right.
I even think that there could be, you know, a role for it in achieving an altered state of consciousness in a intentional ceremonial way of brewing or creating or distilling some type of an elixir that, you know, has a place at that same table. And I think there are maybe even some traditional forms of that. But, you know, I think it has the same dangers and the same pitfalls of alcohol in the way we use it, let's say recreationally or unintentionally.
Yeah, I think what initially drew me to it, a couple of things. One, you know, I was in college freshman year, and I would just go in my roommate's room where he and his buddies were smoking, and I would take just one little hit. You know, they were a year older, wanted to be cool, right? And then I would go back in my room and listen to music with my headphones on. And everything just sounded so much richer, you know? And I was like, fuck, this is it, you know? And that, you know, it was just one toke. And I did that for months, you know, just out, but every night, you know, and then I'd fall asleep, right? But then also like the awareness around it that we kind of inherited from the 60s was counterculture, screw the man, freedom, a little anarchistic kind of, and I really was drawn to that,
mm-hmm.
which was just kind of funny. And there's some dualistic twist there. It's like, oh, you're doing this for freedom. But then if you're doing it every day, you don't have any freedom from it. So it's now become your captor in a way. So yeah, I think the legalization of cannabis is a good step. And I think they've done studies that use in teens goes down a little bit actually once it's legalized, because it doesn't have this mystique or this allure of being something that's illicit or forbidden, right? Yeah, but it's an interesting thing in the culture that I think everyone has some kind of relationship with it. It is so similar to a lot of other medicines or drugs. In that, yeah, a pinch is great in the right time, but a pound is too much. And yeah, I think a lot of creativity has been wasted. A lot of potential has been wasted, my own included. And yeah, just ambivalence and a malaise and, you know, lethargy or unexcitement for life. And that is what I think. And I remember thinking this when I was pretty deep in the habit for many years. I was like, God, why? Like, what if I'm old, 80, and I spent my whole life stoned? like your whole life, like you more or less your whole adult life, you were never clean off of this. And I didn't want that. And so the year of sobriety, really, I think a lot of things like that, abstaining is not like when you set your mind, you know, when you shift your mindset and you're committed and you're focused, it's not that difficult. There would be triggers, of course, like going to Zilker, hanging out with my buddy Connor on the Slack line. Like we always, that was part of it, you know? And so there's some trappings from the historical relationship with it.
That has a tie back to state-based learning.
Yeah, right, right. We're very mechanical, I think, in a lot of, like, wake up, brush my teeth, get the coffee, get the, you know, and then you're just, your body knows.
Yeah.
You know, Dispenza, Joe Dispenza. Mm-hmm. Like your patterns are living your life. Your patterns are dictating your life because we just, there's safety in the routine, I think. There's the known is very comfortable, you know, but I don't think that's a way to live a responsible, but also interesting life, like on autopilot, you know? And so, and it's, but there is like a love affair, you know, and I realize this, and I always realize this when I go now, because my relationship with it now is like every other week or, you know, very, like I have my foot on the brake because I know, and I just experienced this in Toledo. When I was working in Toledo for a month, like I fell back into daily use pretty quickly. And it's supportive. You know, I've said this before too, like the cannabis plant is feminine, right? I think, you know, the male plants don't produce bud. Those usually get eliminated. And so I think it's supportive when you know what you're doing and you've done it many times as a support mechanism. I think it's good. For example, like I'm in the house, I'm working, it's very physical work, flipping a house. And so by 4 o'clock, you're kind of toast, but then you go rip a bone and you've got a little more energy to do another hour of work because you kind of have the energy of the cannabis and some focus potentially, which that's debatable actually, how much it helps your focus.
Or energy for that matter.
Yeah, energy too. You know, you probably get this nice spike, but then when you fall off, you're lower than where you were when you started, you know. But if you don't have a plan and you just smoke, you're not going to develop a plan, you know, in that state. You're not going to be, let's get a plan together.
Step one, get stoned. Step two, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, right, right. You stare at the wall, you know. And I wish, you know, I wish as a society, and this is true for alcohol too, we had better guidelines about when we use this, what's the purpose? When is it supportive? When is it not? You know, I think it's really good for sleep, cannabis, you know, to help people sleep, even though it definitely messes up your REM cycles after you're asleep. You don't recall dreams really. A lot of people don't, including myself, when I've smoked cannabis, which I think is probably connected to the short-term memory effects that cannabis has, right? So you may still be dreaming, but you don't remember them. So what's the point? It's funny, as we're having this conversation, I have all these like axioms about cannabis. And one of them is that, you know, the dream state is it's a gift from the divine, right? Like, and maybe you're even closer to, you leave the physical body and you go up closer to your true essence and who you really, truly are, the non-physical being that we all are. And cannabis snips that off. It removes that. And so I had an idea that one time that people who smoke cannabis are very, very arrogant because they don't need the help from the dreams or the insights they might receive or the guidance they might receive in the dream state because they're completely foregoing that when they use cannabis.
Do you think it suppresses cannabis, that is to say? Do you think it's, I'm hearing you're saying that it suppresses the dream state. I think that's probably right. Do you think it also suppresses visualizations in psychedelic states?
You know, I don't know. I think that my visualizations with ayahuasca were better when I was using. Mm. But it could be that I had this entity that, and I've heard, you know, our shaman has talked about this, like they don't get along. Ayahuasca is a very jealous lady. She doesn't play well with others.
Yeah.
So if you come in there and you're just got high the day before, 2 days before, you're going to have a difficult ceremony. Mm-hmm. Now, I have experienced that. And while my ceremonies now, last year when I wasn't on cannabis, the two that I did, weren't as visual, they also weren't as difficult.
Hmm.
Now with mushrooms, I'm not sure about the visuals. What are your thoughts?
I'm not sure either. I just know that I know about the ayahuasca thing. At the very least, like, it's commonly said that cannabis will suppress ayahuasca visuals.
Mm.
Does it suppress visuals on other psychedelics? I don't think I could speak to that from experience, but I can say that my experience has been that cannabis has a tendency to take any experience to a darker place, whether that's with LSD, psilocybin, sure, or anything else. I don't like to mix it with anything at all, actually, because for me, it has a very dark energy to it. Cannabis does.
Mm. And do you think that's the plant itself or the societal awareness that's followed it?
Could be my own relationship with it, for all I know. I don't know. I know that everybody certainly doesn't have the same experience with cannabis. Additionally, there's 1,001 strains of cannabis that have very different effects.
Right.
You know, all the way from, you know, an almost completely embodied type of indica to, you know, a highly visual inducing sativa and everything in between, right? And so I think it's very much like mushrooms, actually, in the sense that the strains have a character and a personality. And then there's also the difference between, like, when we say cannabis, we could be talking about a form of just a pure form of THC the form of a vaporizer oil or an edible product. Are we talking about Delta 8, Delta 9?
Right. Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. It's a weird situation. I think when I'm talking about cannabis, I think for me, I'm referring to combusting the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about my later life in the last 10 years or so. I've had a lot of experiences that felt darker, more paranoid, unpleasant generally. Although I've also had some really, really peak experiences when I'm using it very intentionally without not in combination with other things,
right,
and especially in the realms of sex and music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As far as like a really beautiful way to enjoy sensual, loving, intimate communion with someone, especially in an actual sexual state, it's off the charts. Yeah. It can be off the charts.
Mm.
And also, like you said earlier about appreciation of music, there's just something it does to your brain.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like if you're looking at, like, let's say a beautiful painting or a visual art piece, in a normal state of awareness, you kind of see the entire picture. This is an analogy to music, but it's like, if you are in a very, you know, if you're in a positive feeling, heightened cannabis induced state, it's almost like different elements of that picture, like, separate themselves from each other, and you can see the layers, you can experience the complexity and the richness and the layering of the sound in a completely different way. And
yeah, it's almost like you weren't listening to it before.
Yeah.
Like
you weren't hearing it. And then you're just listening to it. You're not hearing it.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then you smoke, you're like, oh yes, this is
right, right, this, right. Yeah. It's like it takes something that feels like one layer, and now all of a sudden it could feel like 100 layers, like, and they're all hitting you in different ways and parts of your experience.
We've arrived at another joke.
What's that?
What did the Widespread Panic fan say when he ran out of weed?
I give up.
This music sucks.
I was going to say something like that.
Yeah, God, this music sucks.
Yeah.
People say it about Fish or whatever, a billion bands. But one positive, because I do want to spend our time in support of my sobriety knocking on cannabis. But I think one positive, other than the music, other than the sex, is the sense of companionship from especially a daily user.
Really?
I think that's why I held on to it. There are two reasons why I think I personally had a kind of leaning towards it. Was one, I grew up in a fairly chaotic home structure. I mean, it was, there was a lot of love, but there was a lot of arguing and disorganization too, right? And so as an adult, the discombobulating state while high is reminiscent, like I'm more comfortable in a chaotic state in a way, because that's how I was raised. So I think there's that component of it, which may be a stretch, admittedly. But also when I was like traveling or spending time, you know, when I do the hostels, I'm alone for a lot of that time, staying in a house by myself in a city where I don't know anyone, the cannabis feels like a friend. Mm. You know, it's a familiar, there she is again, you know, and you take that to the shadow of that is that, you know, I'm getting married this year. I'm 40, never got close with one or two women maybe before, but never been married before. And part of me thinks is, yeah, because you were already married to the cannabis. But you didn't have space for more feminine energy in your life because you already had this thing that satiated your desire for companionship or romance, which is kind of sad. And I do think another situation that happened this past year is I was in Chicago with my partner. She wanted to get some edibles to help her sleep, you know? So we went by the cannabis store and I kind of got triggered when I went in there. Like, I can't use this thing anymore. All these substances in my life, like alcohol or even tobacco, I use them so much that I ruin them for myself. You know, I overuse them. And so now, I said, you know, babe, I want to go out. I'm just going to sit in the car. And so then I just watched the people walking into that store. Like, these are not my people. Mm-hmm. No judgment, but mm-hmm. just a little sloppy and a little disheveled and, you know, haven't had a haircut in a while. You know, they just loose energy, just yes. looser energy. And so
yes.
that was kind of like an aha. Not that there's plenty of CEOs that smoke every day and high performance people that smoke every day, of course, but I think they're outliers. I think the majority of potheads and stoners are people. And when I look at my own life, you know, I have a large group of people I know and friends and whatever. When I look at the people who are stoners and have been stoners for 20 years, their manifestation cap is lower than those who don't use cannabis. And that's loose. That's a small study case or study group or sample size, but it's real and in my own life. And I can look at that and say, yeah, it's, you know, you asked me earlier in the conversation, what's been like getting you off or what's been exciting you lately? And this quote that I may have gotten from JJ actually is, every action is a vote for who you want to be, which is really empowering because every day we can choose, okay, do I want to go exercise or do I want to sit on the couch and eat donuts or do I want to, you know, and you're casting a vote for who you're trying to be. And cannabis, like you cast that, there are compounding effects because you cast that vote at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, you're not going to be casting too many more votes after that. And if you do, they're not probably going to be the most productive, you know? So I think,
I'm just imagining all of the votes that you cast while you're stoned. It's like a scrawl on a piece of paper and instead of putting it in the ballot box, you'd like put it in the toilet.
Yeah. Well, you know, another story I was thinking about recently, you know, I went to this really beautiful rafting trip through the Grand Canyon and I was not using cannabis at this time. This is a few months back. And of course, one of the very important lesson or rules in the canyon is you do not get on the boat without your life jacket on, right? If you're on the boat, you have to have your PFD on at all times. And of course, yeah, no problem following that rule. And then on the third day, it's a 5-day trip. On the third day, I was like, man, this is amazing. Wonder how it will be on an edible, you know? So I took an edible and after lunch, like, jumped on the boat and someone's like, Fry, you forgot your jacket. My life jacket's still on the beach. I'm like, oh shit. And so for anyone to say, oh, it doesn't affect you or, oh, it's not that big of a deal. That's hogwash. Like you're stoned, you know, and your faculties are diminished.
Well, look at the word.
Sure.
Stoned.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say high. You could say that, but stoned, like it, the connotation is correct. It's like, you know, getting hit upside the head with a rock.
Right. Blitzed, barbecued. I mean, there's a lot of words. One of my issues is like, I just love smoking. Like I smoked cigarettes for 10 years, I like cigars. And so sometimes it's I don't want the cannabis as much as I just like the tactile, physical sensation of smoking something, which, you know, another thought I've had about smoking and cannabis is, you know, we talk about, of course, it's bad for your lungs, but I think something that's interesting is that I'm assuming that because we evolved around campfires for thousands and thousands of years, our lungs are very good at regenerating themselves because we were breathing campfire smoke. And so I think our lungs, for that reason, are quite hardy.
Do you suppose that's how we figured some of these things out? Like throwing whatever weeds happen to be laying around on the campfire, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, hello.
Right, put some more of that on.
What do we got here?
Yeah. Well, have you ever seen the video of the fireman that grow house was caught on fire? And he had to put it out, and he comes out, and he's fucking baked. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, and it's just secondhand, you know, I mean, just breathing. So obviously, yeah, that'll get you there. I mean, I think that was probably how we figured a lot of things out.
Yeah.
Throw it on the fire, and then can we eat it?
Yeah.
You know, does it make it better?
That's always been something that I've been a little bit curious about, is how that process would have gotten started. Because when you're talking about like, oh, I just enjoy smoking, it's like, but I wonder if you would enjoy smoking if you hadn't learned through state-based learning mm-hmm. that it gets you high. Like, would you enjoy smoking if it was just like drinking water in terms of the effect that it has on, like, if you're getting the whole experience of it, except no nicotine buzz, no cannabis
yeah,
high.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I should
probably not.
Probably not. I mean, probably I wouldn't keep Damiana, doing it. Damiana before, and it's kind of like, yeah, I can take it or leave it.
I think that we, and certainly I fall into this category myself, you know, I smoked for several years. And had that same association with it. Like, oh, I really enjoy this process, this action. But I think we almost force ourselves to learn that, to create that association by like going back to it over and over and over again, seeking the actual medicine experience. Mm. But then in the process, it's like guilt by association, or our brains and bodies learn that, oh, this action has a payoff.
Right. Yeah.
And so then it's like, have you heard of the cargo cult phenomenon?
Bro. Yes. And I have a thought on that.
Great.
It's not related at all to cannabis, but
that's okay.
Okay, great. Yes. I know. I read a great novel, about cargo cults, but
yeah,
maybe for the audience, you should explain it.
Yeah, I will explain it. And I'm trying to say that this thing that you're saying, like, well, I just enjoy the act of smoking, I think is really just a cargo cult phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The cargo cults are, I hate to tell this story because I don't know the details precisely. And so I hate to like misrepresent a culture or a people or a specific place in the world where this was happening. But to the best of my understanding of it, during World War II, right?
World War I or World War II, yeah.
In the Pacific Islands, when Americans or allied forces were staging airstrips, runways, airfields on different islands where, you know, we're trying to capture or invade. We're doing these island hopping invasions and whatever. We'd stage equipment, gear, build runways and do these things on all these different islands where maybe some indigenous people lived, and would provide material, medicine, food, equipment, or whatever to them kind of as a way of keeping the peace. Then when the war was over, packed up and left, and the people who were there who didn't necessarily understand everything that was going on just formed these associations between, okay, well, these magical materials show up and bring benefit to our lives, and they come because there's Quonset huts and there's runways and there's radio towers, and they form the association of these things happen, and then the cargo shows up. And so they would attempt to rebuild the airfields in an attempt to like entice these gods or whatever to come and bring the cargo. So I think that's what's happening with the mechanical act of smoking, is it's like you're building the airfield hoping that the cargo is going to show up, but it's like, that's not really the point.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely smoked cigarettes long before I smoked cannabis. And, you know, it's funny, like that hit, that nicotine hit is for a child who's 14, 13 or 14, he's never had it before. It's not psychedelic, but very impactful.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And yeah. Then, and of course, everyone, to your point, the first thing they do when they inhale a cigarette is cough.
Right.
You know, because it's a foreign object that's not naturally supposed to be in your lungs. And then you kind of get over that. And
you force yourself to get over it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of stoners, you know, if you're not choking, you're not toking. Like they want to cough because.
You got to cough to get off.
Got to cough. That's right. Because it opens the capillaries in your lungs and you get higher, et cetera. You know, but I think all of the culture around smoking, you know, cigarettes were put in every movie and cigars are masculine. And, you know, we have these ideas about it too. And so part of that is probably at play. But there's a relaxing kind of casual component to smoking that I'm either attracted to because there's going to be some payoff I'm waiting on, or society has said this is what people do to relax. So I'm not saying it's totally natural, but
I'll bet if you got a hold of some herbal blend, some non-tobacco, non-nicotine, not even Damiana or Blue Lotus, but just like some like tasty herbal blend of some sort, and rolled some cigarettes and smoked them, you'd probably go, this is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
I'm just guessing. I know there are some people who enjoy that because there's a market for it, apparently. Like, you know, these blends exist and you can buy them. But I don't know, man. I just think that smoking as a pastime is not really the point.
Yeah, well, I think culture bears that out, our current culture, because now people use Zen.
Right.
Which is nicotine.
Or snus for that
matter.
Yeah,
or snus. You know, but Zen doesn't even have tobacco.
What's Zen? I don't even know what that is.
Zen. It's funny branding. But ZYN, and it's a little can, and it's a little white powder.
Oh, it's nicotine, though.
But it's nicotine.
Yeah.
And there's like 3 milligrams or 6 milligrams.
There's a comedian
that's super popular.
Okay, yeah. There's a comedian whose podcast I listen to who keeps talking about doing Zens. Yeah. And I've never understood what it's all about, but it sounded really trashy.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay.
But it helps with, nicotine helps with focus. I mean, nicotine is a great compound, I think, a great molecule or whatever, you know, substance.
Why do you say that?
Because I like it.
Okay. Yeah.
No, but it helps with focus. They've done studies with dementia, and it helps people who have dementia. Kind of have better cognitive abilities temporarily, of course, only while they're using it. But yeah, I don't know if I want to segue into my cargo cult thought or not, because it doesn't have anything to do with cannabis. I may have gotten this idea while high, but other than that,
that's close enough.
Okay, so you know I have this fascination with Catholic cathedrals,
yeah,
and buildings and Tartaria, right?
Yes,
but came to me recently that our use of these buildings and Christianity to a large part, but mainly the use of these buildings, because I believe that they were possibly here already and we found them. And that's why cities were founded, because we found them. And then that's when it was founded, because that's the year we found it. And they dug them out of the mud and cleaned them up and started using them as worship halls, never knowing what they were originally used for, which were maybe like healing centers and frequency centers by a civilization that was at a higher consciousness than we are now. And so we, on a societal level, are like a cargo cult that we use these buildings, but we have no idea what the original use was.
Mm.
So that was a fun one.
Mm. I just saw something on my news aggregator site that like the world's largest pyramid has been discovered in Croatia or
Bosnia.
Bosnia. Yeah, Bosnia. That's
it. Yeah.
And I saw a picture of it, and it's like obviously a pyramid. It's like, right. What do you mean you discovered it?
Right.
It's like there's this giant ass pyramid covered with land or covered with
trees and foliage. Yeah.
Foliage. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's clearly a geometrically correct pyramid with this like town just at the base, like
right.
around the base of it. Like, did they just think that's just a normal mountain? Like, come on, what do you mean discovered? Like,
I don't know.
But anyway, that's pretty interesting to me. These pyramids, I don't know about you, but I certainly don't remember learning as a kid that there are pyramids all over the world. Like, I heard they were just in Egypt or whatever, right. maybe a ziggurat here or there mm-hmm. in Mexico, mm-hmm. maybe some mounds or something. But like these huge, massive, like great pyramid sized or bigger pyramids all over the world. That's weird.
Yeah. Why do you think they built them?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing.
Did you hear the Bosnian pyramid is that they're like, well, it was on your news feed. So maybe they didn't get into like the healing properties. Like a lot of it's made of quartz and people are going in them and their ailments are being cured. If you stay in there longer, it structures your cells. And yeah, they're fascinating.
Now, but so here's where we, you know, diverge into Mandarin Man vision, old familiar territory.
Okay.
How do we know any of this shit is real? Just because we see it on a screen.
Oh, sure.
How do we know any of this shit is real? Now, you've traveled the world a lot more than I have and actually seen some shit.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen some cathedrals and
seen
stuff
the pyramids,
like that.
Yeah.
You've seen the actual pyramids
mm-hmm.
in Egypt?
Mm-hmm. 2 years ago.
All right. Well, that's real.
Went in one of them. It's real.
Yeah.
They're there.
Mm-hmm.
They're awesome.
You know. Like, I don't know. Do you ever get paranoid? What is Brett Weinstein and Heather Heying are calling it the Cartesian crisis.
Mm.
The Cartesian crisis is basically like the breakdown of our ability to know truth.
Mm. Yes.
To know reality, because we already know we can't believe a lot of shit.
Right.
That's coming through the screens or wherever it's coming from, coming through the computers and all that stuff. But like, how do we... And we've had had variations of this conversation before. Just the pollution of the information ecosystem, and how do we decide what's true?
Yeah, well, my mom always said, "Don't believe anything you hear, and only half of what you see," because there's just so much falsehood, you know. And yeah, I think the internet has exacerbated that. And authority has always lied on some level to keep the peace. And now we just do that digitally and largely through pacification, right? You know, watch this football game or whatever. And I think that's why it is important to get out and like go see things, you know, put your hand on these objects or these relics. I don't know where to even start with that. Like, because it's, I think it's scary for a lot of people. We all think we have a pretty good handle on the world. And I think that's the benefit of psychedelics is it's like, takes that handle and loosens it a little bit, you know, or gives you an extra handle, right? To kind of hold your, so you have two handles, you have two hands, you know. But so I'm actually more of a fan of Eric Weinstein. Don't know Brett's work. I know he has a podcast with his wife. I mean, what is their remedy for this?
They're trying to puzzle it out, you know?
You're right.
They don't necessarily have a slam dunk answer for it, but they're trying to puzzle it out. And, you know, it has to do with fighting back against censorship. It has to do with creating communities and lines of communication between people who are earnest truth seekers and really want to just use the best critical thinking faculties at our disposal and say like, okay, this is what we know. This is what we don't know. This is what might be true. This is what still needs to be verified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really just going back to old school empirical reasoning.
Yeah. Cause this could get a lot worse with deep fakes and AI and a lot of that.
See, what I'm thinking is that actually we're a lot further down the path than what we think we are. Meaning, I think technology is actually a few years, I don't know how many, 5 or 10 or 20. I think technology is actually several years ahead of what the mainstream is allowed to
Okay.
to realize.
So is that what you think the UAPs are? they're our own.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know.
And so the way that the iPhone, the way they make the functional obsolescence, or they only increase the technology incrementally on purpose because, so they can sell more phones, they're doing that at a larger scale.
I'm thinking, and I don't think this idea is even particularly controversial. I think that military organizations, government organizations, maybe even corporations that are trying to maintain a competitive advantage. I think there's a lot of different groups and areas where technology may actually have advanced substantially.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's not being released publicly or widely, but it may actually be being used in secret. Like, for example, I'll give you an example, like this AI large language model thing. Mm-hmm. I worked in the information technology industry for 20 years. I can tell you that from my experience, the way this so-called AI, and I've got a lot of like strong opinions about it, but the way this so-called AI suddenly came on the scene doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm. I'm not saying that we didn't see it coming. It's been predicted for a long time. It's even been, in my opinion, hyped, you know, overly hyped, extraordinarily hyped for a long time that like we're going to reach this particular point of general artificial intelligence, and there's been developments, there's been breakthroughs and things of that nature. But the jump in terms of the tools that were generally available or even like known to exist happened way quicker than what I ever experienced as the normal technology development cycle in IT. It was like one year the tools are super dumb and pretty bad. And the next year, all of a sudden, you got ChatGPT. And it's like, wait a second. And I'm not saying that I actually think ChatGPT is very good. Mm-hmm. I actually don't. Right. And I think more and more, the more and more like exposure that these LLMs actually get and being pressed into all kinds of service that they're, in my opinion, not really ready for, not actually like fully developed or fully baked technology to be getting just shoved into every search engine, you know, every chat, you know, website, everything under the sun. But they're not like, I don't know, I'm about to go down a whole rabbit hole in terms of what I think of AI, but I want to stay on the main point, which is just that no matter how good or bad they are now, that happened in like a blink of an eye, technologically speaking, or like in terms of like computer development. And that just seems really strange to me. Mm. And there seems like there's a lot of that kind of thing happening now, where it's like all of a sudden there's this reveal and, oh, all of a sudden we've got this tech is available, right, or that capability.
I totally agree. I mean, that's part of the big Tartaria idea is the Antiquitech. And they had these like Zeppelins, for example, where very low cost travel. They were huge. They were luxury. You had plenty of rooms, and we quit using them from one incident. And now we're all shoved in these little airplanes where no one's got any legroom, and everybody hates it. You know, basically air travel. There's definitely a suppression of technology.
That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you've heard all. There's so many stories. Oh, so and so built a car that runs on water, and then the dude's dead in, you know, 2 weeks. Oops. You know, and. You know, there's patents for tires that you never have to change, but Firestone and Goodyear, they own these patents because they're not going to ever put them out, because then there goes the tire industry.
Yeah, that's like the flip side of what I'm saying. I think that's also true, or I think that's also happening.
I see what you mean.
But the flip side of what I'm saying is I also think they're holding back. Mm. And I think there's stuff that's actually being used today that is like what we would consider to be future technology or stuff that doesn't yet exist or hasn't yet been developed, but is actually being used with, among, and on us that hasn't yet been revealed.
Right.
But then I also think there's things that have been held back for a long time that are now being revealed suddenly. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just hard for me to believe that this LLM thing came out of left field this fast.
Yeah. And from a private company.
Yeah.
And not the federal government.
Yeah.
Black
Ops. And it also makes me think that, like, whatever they're giving us today, as far as LLMs are concerned, you know, whatever we're dealing with right now, ChatGPT 4 or 4.5 or whatever version it is, they're probably holding back 6, 7,
right,
and whatever stuff that might actually be comparable to true artificial intelligence, which, again, I don't think these toys that they're letting us play with, they're actually not that great.
Right.
If you've really interacted with them that much.
Yeah. Well, I saw something the other day. It's like, okay, if you ask ChatGPT, it takes 3 hours to dry 3 towels. Did you see that? You know, how long does it take to dry 9 towels? And it's like, it takes 9 hours. It's like, no, it doesn't. If you know, still 3 hours.
Yeah.
You have 100 towels. If the line's long enough.
It basically does act like an intelligent person of an IQ of about 60.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which is, it's learning from those people.
Exactly. It's like, well, you gave it the internet to learn from. Like, what do you expect?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Man. My number one love now, especially in the conspiratorial realm, is Tartaria.
Yeah.
And it was something. It's on tons of old maps. You can see it right there. Grand Tartar or Tartaria or just Tartar. And even in the Vatican, I was there 2-3 years ago. There's this huge hall. You know, you walk down to where Da Vinci did the ceiling. And I forget what that particular room is called. But then when you leave, there's like this massive hallway filled with relics. You know, I mean, everything's gilded and gold. And they had this old massive globe. And right there in black and white, Tartaria. You know, and so, and this globe was from the 1500s. And one of a new thing I discovered on it was like the Great Wall of China, the I guess they're called like battlements or the little cutouts where you would shoot through. They're on the wrong side. They're facing China. Yeah. And so it's not the Great Wall of China. It was the Great Wall of Tartaria meant to keep the Chinese out. You know, that the Tartarians built or the Mongols built. Someone built. I mean, it's an incredible feat of engineering. And so, yeah, I, as far as like what is truth, I don't think we have a fucking clue. Like, you know, and history is in fact someone else's story that they've told us, and yeah, for control or just to you know, who knows, you know. A lot of people think there's been a reset, and actually probably a couple of resets. And so the last few hundred years, you know, we have these stories and these ideas about this country and how it was founded, but how much of that, because in a pre-internet world, you could change the story in 1 to 2 generations. If you wiped out all the young people, changed all the stories, and then 20, 30 years later, had birthing farms or orphan trains, which they had, and created this whole new population and sent these children out and raised them in your schools to learn your story, then they never know what really happened. And yeah, so did that happen? I don't know.
Yeah, but can't they do that even more easily now?
In a post-internet world, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I've got my printed copy of the Oxford English Dictionary in my library, because they're changing the words.
Changing the words.
Changing the language.
Then what do we have? Yeah, nothing, not much. You know.
It's like, go read 1984.
But I think on a soul level, and we've talked about this before, we kind of like that.
We do?
Yeah. Please tie me up and throw me in prison again. I had so much fun getting out and just play the game.
You're
again.
Saying the Earth game is just a big escape room.
Yes. The biggest escape room. That's funny. Escape planet. Yeah.
Who are you, Mandarin Man?
Who am I? I'm a curious cat. I am a lover. I'm a fighter. Third generation conspiracy theorist, lover of fruit. I'm a bit of a consumption junkie and substances. And, you know, I love life, love to eat it up. And a bit of an experience junkie. Like I, you know, when I was younger, I went and ran with the bulls and, you know, been to 38 countries and lived in Guatemala. Like I just like to get out there and see what is what. And because I think those experiences really, like, I've always, I like this idea that we're kind of like USB plugs. So you plug yourself into your family and your community, you download all that information, then you plug yourself into high school. They download a bunch of books and nonsense, good things and bad things to you. Then you go plug yourself into a university, and then you go plug yourself into your first job, and you get their code of conduct and ethics. And so the more situations you can kind of plug yourself into, you draw information from that experience that bolsters your overall being. So, I mean, I think we're all like a little cell or speck of God trying to experience itself and play this game, which is probably the best game in the universe, one of. Like, people tend to love it.
Okay. Well, that was fun.
That was good.
Yep.
They're always better when you listen back.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Thanks for joining me for this sacred conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And don't forget that the conversation can always continue. We can build on a topic that we've already talked about, and we can also start new topics and see how they all weave together. And that's just the exciting thing about this whole journey of exploration, is we don't know where it's going to go, but I'm really excited to find out with you. Please don't be shy to reach out and schedule your sacred conversation on whatever topic is interesting to you. Thanks a lot, and I look forward to talking with you soon.